This year, Radio 3's World Roots Academy has focused on the remarkable and little-known musical culture of Azerbaijan. Join me, Lucy Duran, at the BBC Proms as our Academy protégé, the young singer Fidan Hajiyeva, performs alongside her mentor.
There's me singing around the house on chairs.
On chairs?
Yeah, I would go up on chairs and start singing.
Also on the bill, two groups from Mali, a world debut by a new ensemble of master musicians, Trio Dakali, plus one of the biggest stars on the world music scene, Baseku Kouyaté and Ngoniwa. Join us tomorrow night at 10 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening. It's coming up to 7:30. Time now to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Penny Gore.
The BBC Symphony Orchestra is back at the Royal Albert Hall tonight with Chief Conductor Sakari Oromo continuing his first prom season in the post. Later, he'll be conducting music by Edward Elgar, a composer he's championed for years, with such commitment that he's now the proud holder of an Elgar Medal. We'll hear the Enigma Variations to end the concert. Before them is the colourfully scored Celtic Symphony by Granville Bantock, whose music is featured at the proms this year. And former Radio 3 New Generation artist Lisa Batiashvili joins the orchestra to play Sibelius's Violin Concerto. But to begin, we'll hear the latest of this season's world premieres. Param Veer was born in Delhi and studied in London and in the USA. His teachers included Peter Maxwell Davis and Oliver Nussen. He's always taken inspiration from his love of mythology, art and literature, and he's drawn in the past on Buddhist teachings. Well, that's just what he did for the BBC commission we're about to hear, Cave of Luminous Mind. He explains how that title came about.
Well, Milarepa was this Tibetan saint who was practicing meditation in the mountains of Tibet. And he moved from cave to cave over several years, and the cave sustained him and gave him shelter. He gave subsequently many of these caves very beautiful names. One of these caves was called the Cave of Luminous Awareness. And that directly inspired the title of my work, because luminous awareness and luminous mind are some of the principal goals of Buddhist meditation, which aims to attain enlightenment. And that was Milarepa's goal.
Param Veer talking about the BBC commission. We're about to hear its world premiere in a couple of minutes to open this concert given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the ensemble which is really the backbone of this prom season, and the last night not too far away now, and that will be their last concert of the season as ever. But tonight we have this wonderful programme, and very characteristic of the proms, some great favourites in the form of the Elgar, something new in the form of the Granville Bantock, a commission in the form of this piece by Param Veer, and of course a concerto with Lisa Batiashvili playing the Sibelius. And applause for the guest leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Simon Blendis, making his way to his seat at the front of the stage. And Cave of Luminous Mind, which we're about to hear, is dedicated to the memory of the late Jonathan Harvey, one of Param Veer's teachers and someone whose name is so well remembered here at the proms. And here comes Sakari Oromo to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in the world premiere of this BBC commission by Param Veer.
Thank you.
Zachary Oromo conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Cave of Luminous Mind by Param Veer. And he's here tonight to hear this world premiere. His first work at the Proms was heard in 2005, also performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Another piece inspired by Buddhist teachings, Horse Tooth, White Rock. And in fact, right after tonight's concert, you can hear Param Veer talking to Andrew McGregor in a Proms composer portrait, which was recorded earlier today. That's here on Radio 3 after the end of this prom at 10:15. And Param Veer has made his way on stage now to join Zachary Oromo and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And a bow from composer and conductor. As I said before, the work dedicated with gratitude and in remembrance to Param Veer's teacher, Jonathan Harvey. His music, says Param Veer, embodied qualities of light in an astonishing proliferation of pieces, and his creative vision brought forth so many works fired by the wisdom of Buddhism, something that also governs Param Veer's approach to music making. As I say, you can hear more about that in the Proms Composer Portrait later this evening, 10:15. Well, as Param Veer and Zachary Oromo make their way off stage, the members of the orchestra do a little minimal readjustment now, making ready for Lisa Batiashvili. She'll be joining them in a couple of minutes as the soloist in Sibelius's Violin Concerto, a work that holds some vivid memories for her.
Well, my first ever Sibelius Violin Concerto, I performed in 1995 at the finals of the Sibelius Violin Competition, and that was with Zachary Oromo. It was a time when he had just starting his conducting career, and the way I understood this piece was very much influenced by how he conducted that. The first time I played, I had very little idea about what was going on in the orchestra. We had only one short rehearsal, and this became really a very important moment in my life. And since then, of course, we have performed a lot together. We recorded Sibelius Concerto in 2006, and here we are now, many years later, and we perform it again. And I think that every time I've done this piece with Zachary, I felt that it was the most natural, most passionate way to perform this piece.
Lisa Batiashvili, and as she said, she and Zachary Oromo have performed it often since that first attempt together. Well, I say attempt, but it was a very accomplished performance, because when she took part in the Sibelius competition at just 16, she won second place, so not too shabby at all, I think you could say. Well, Sibelius himself, I'm sure, would have been delighted to have got to that level of eminence, because he was himself a frustrated violinist. For many years, it was his dearly held wish to be a great virtuoso. He did take lessons from his early teenage years, and at one point he did even audition for the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. But he had to accept eventually that he just didn't have that special spark that fitted him out for stardom. Must have made it very hard for him when in 1903 he started work on this concerto. But a violinist acquaintance had suggested that he write a work for the instrument, and his friend Axel Karpelan backed him up. The result was the piece we're about to hear. And here comes Lisa Batiashvili, accompanied by Zachary Oromo, for their performance with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Sibelius's Violin Concerto.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Violin Concerto by Jean Sibelius, revised by the composer after its first performances because he felt the reviews were a little on the lukewarm side. Well, the solo part may have ended up slightly less showy, but goodness me, it's still magnificently virtuosic. And Lisa Betiashvili has wowed the audience tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall with her artistry, together with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sakari Oromo. Finnish-born, of course, so he too has this music, you could say, well, running in his veins. And he and Lisa Batiashvili have gone on to record it together alongside a concerto by Magnus Lindberg. And here they are, soloist and conductor back on stage. Lisa Batiashvili, such a committed performer. Slender, reed-like, in a beautiful dark blue and glittering silver dress, and attacks this piece with just tremendous concentration. I said earlier she's a graduate of Radio 3's New Generation Artist Scheme, and in fact she was one of the very first group in 1999. She's certainly gone on to prove just what a compelling performer she is. She's been artist in residence this season with Cologne's WDR Symphony Orchestra, and she's held a similar role with the Dresden Staatskapelle. She's also a great chamber music player, and from watching her in rehearsal this morning, she's certainly been taken to the hearts of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And she returns to the stage alone now, puts her hand to her heart and bows to the audience, cheers from all around, and she turns to the choir stalls behind the orchestra here as well, and the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra showing their appreciation for that performance too. She's won many awards for her recordings, and she's given many first performances of new works too, including the one I mentioned, the Violin Concerto by Magnus Lindberg. And she's coming back on stage with Zachary Oromo and her violin in hand.
Thank you.
An encore from Lisa Batiashvili's native Georgia. Lale by Sulkan Tsintsadze. And Lisa Batiashvili is from a highly musical family. Her father, Tomasz Batiashvili, is also a string player, and he made that arrangement for violin and small string orchestra. Lisa Batiashvili and members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Well, as she goes off stage, accompanied by Sakari Oromo, that brings us to the midway point in tonight's concert. In the second half of this prom, Sakari Oromo returns to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in works by Elgar and Bantok. Well, until 5 years ago, Oromo was the conductor of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, and it's to Birmingham and the Midlands that we go for the next 20 minutes. Both Elgar and Bantok held the post of Professor of Music at the University of Birmingham, but their respective tenures couldn't have been more different. Former Birmingham student Fiona Clampin has been exploring the archives of the university and visiting the Elgar Birthplace Museum to find out how the fortunes of the two men became intertwined in the one city.
The story goes that if you walk under the base of the clock tower at the University of Birmingham when you're a student here, you'll fail your degree. Needless to say, when I was studying here, I gave the place a wide berth. Having said that, it was pretty easy because the music department then was across the other side of the campus. But since last year, it's moved to a brand new building opposite the clock tower. It's worth having a quick look because there are a few people featured inside who are central to this evening's prom. We're in the Bramall Building, which is home to the university's music department. And on my left, there are several paintings and a bust of Sir Edward Elgar. Standing next to them is Peyton Professor of Music, Andrew Kirkman. Andrew, why is this bust here?
Well, Elgar was the first professor here. He took the position up in 1905, very much at the height of his powers then. He'd composed Gerontius and the Apostles and the Enigma Variations, still the violin concerto and cello concerto to come, of course, and the symphonies.
He'd received a knighthood the year before, hadn't he?
Yes, it was really quite a coup for the university to get him, because lots of other places were vying for his services. But thanks to some intervention by Granville Bantok, his close friend and colleague, and a few other people who were close to him and had some influence, we managed to persuade him in 1905 to come here.
So what made this chair of music possible? I think if we go on a little bit further, we've got a painting.
Yeah. So this is Richard Peyton, who was a local businessman and music lover, who decided he would like to put some money into supporting music in the university to create a new base for music here and a prestigious department. And it was his idea to give Elgar the chair. In fact, it was a stipulation of his endowment that Elgar take up this chair. And he gave no less than £10,000, which was a huge amount of money in those days, yes.
Dear Mr. Chamberlain, I address myself to you as Chancellor of the University of Birmingham in order to make a proposal which, should it be approved by the authorities of the university, may, I hope, be to the advantage of the university and for the advancement of musical art. There is, at the present time, a special opportunity of offering an appointment to a chair of music in the university to one of the most eminent of English musicians, whether of the past or the present time. And the offer which I have the honour and pleasure to make is to contribute a sum of £10,000 for the endowment of such a chair, the only condition being that it should, in the first instance, be offered to and accepted by Sir Edward Elgar. I have always taken a deep interest in the musical life of the city, and hope that should my proposal be accepted, the results would enhance the reputation which Birmingham already enjoys, and that in the not distant future it would become one of the most important centres of musical art. Yours sincerely, Richard Peyton.
This was Peyton's formal approach to Birmingham, but Elgar had known for some time that he was being lined up for the post. In the 2 weeks before Peyton's letter, Elgar dithered over whether or not to accept the chair of music. He wasn't an intellectual and could occasionally be contemptuous of academia. In fact, in one of his letters, he said that all professors, except Parry, neglect to wash. I have in my hands Elgar's wife Alice's diary from 1904, which is held here in the university's archives, and the various entries make Elgar's hesitation clear. Saturday, November the 12th, 1904. Professor Fiedler, he was the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, came over about chair of music at Birmingham. Long talk with E. Left at 4:20. We go on to Sunday, November the 20th. Very anxious how to decide Birmingham. Thursday, November the 24th, 1904. E. very anxious over decision about Birmingham. Interestingly, there's a mention here in Alice's diaries on November the 17th about a visit from Granville Bantock. Alice records that he came to talk to Elgar about the Birmingham Chair of Music and left the following day by the 11:30 train. Bantock was, at the time, principal of the Birmingham and Midland Institute School of Music, a post for which Elgar had recommended him, and the two men had been friendly for a number of years, as letters held by the Elgar Birthplace Museum near Worcester make clear.
My dear Elgar, I have heard and read of your success with Gerontius in Dusseldorf and rejoice at the honour you are bringing to our English music. But as you ascend the ladder and a few discordant cries are heard from those in high places, you will gain an increasing number of friends and admirers, among whom I hope you will always rank me. For though my desires for energetic work can find no outlet in my present cramped position, if ever the day should come, I'll set my shoulder to your chariot and push it forward with all my power. I've some glorious tobacco for you to try. Our warmest love, Gran. P.S. Did you find those phoenix eggs?
In 1901, Bantock rallied round Elgar's friends to help present Elgar with the robes he was to wear to receive his honorary doctorate from Cambridge, and Bantock also offered Elgar a post at the Midland Institute. Elgar, in his turn, dedicated the Pomp and Circumstance March No. 2 to his friend.
My dear Elgar, I did not know about one of the marches bearing my name until just lately. I had heard rumours, but nothing definite. I much appreciate your generous thought, though your risk is great. You definitely acknowledge me as a friend, one who is regarded by any of our kind-hearted brother musicians as an arch-devil, lunatic, and irresponsible. But you have been a good friend to me. Yours always, G.B.
The key thing to remember about Bantock and Elgar is that there's an 11-year difference in their ages.
English music expert Lewis Foreman.
But they both emerged much at the same time as sort of significant dominant figures, and that's around about 1900. And so by 1904, 1905, they'd both become well established. But the first time Bantock met Elgar was in 1899 when Bantock, newly married and newly appointed as director of the music at the Tower, New Brighton, invited Elgar to stay so that Elgar could give the second performance of Enigma Variations. It was a great success, and so when, 2 years later, the post of principal of the Birmingham and Midland School of Music came up, Elgar was in a position to recommend Bantock to get the job. And then, as the principal of the Birmingham and Midland School of Music, when Elgar got invited to do the lectures for Birmingham University, Bantock, of course, was there sitting in the background, effectively, de facto, already doing the job.
So, having accepted the Birmingham chair with some misgivings and a list of conditions, Elgar began to prepare for his first lecture.
Dear Professor Fiedler, yes, Thursday, March the 16th at 6:30. Subject, A Future for English Music. In greatest haste, yours very sincerely, Edward Elgar.
Elgar and his wife arrived by train and were met by Richard Peyton. The lecture was delivered not at the university, but at the Midland Institute, which perhaps reflected the collaboration Elgar and Peyton were looking to develop with Bantock's School of Music. E looks most beautiful in gown and hood, Alice wrote in her diary. Organ played his tunes, crowded hall. E lectured most splendidly, held his audience breathless.
I stand here in a position new to me, made for me. A position of responsibility, and it may be of honour. While acknowledging how inadequate I am for this post of the Richard Peyton Professor of Music, I will say at once that I intend to shirk none of the responsibility and will try my best to add to the honour of the position by drawing round me some of the best minds connected with our art.
So far, so good. but Elgar warmed to his theme with characteristic bluntness. English music expert Lewis Foreman.
I think he was trying to be diplomatic, but being Elgar, he did have the points that he wanted to put across. Now, in that first lecture, which is called A Future for English Music, and which, of course, attracted enormous attention and enormous press coverage, almost anything he said was bound to be picked up and pulled apart. And so everybody was quick to notice that if he, for example, attacked programme music, he was probably having a go at specific living composers. And it's when he had a go at rhapsodies and said they weren't English that everybody assumed that he was attacking Stamford. Now, taking 1880 as his starting point, without naming names, he discussed the music written in the succeeding 20 years. And he said, quote, "Some of us who in that year were young and taking an active part in music felt that something at last was going to be done in the way of composition by the English school." And he really decided that, quote, "It's saddening for those who hoped so much from those early days to find that after all that had been written and all the endeavour to excite enthusiasm for English music, to find he'd inherited an art which has no hold on the affections of our own people and is held in no respect abroad." And that was one of his main points throughout the series. Although the English composers were writing music, it had no hold on the affection of our own people and is held in no respect abroad.
Elgar's first lecture was widely reported in the national press, although what I've got here is something closer to home, the Birmingham student magazine The Mermaid from March 1905. In amongst the reports of the pantomime, the hockey and the football clubs and the various student societies, there's an editorial which includes a reference to a lecture by someone they call Sir Edwin Elgar. It can hardly be said that our new professor is a born speaker, and we fear that a number of those present were hardly so interested as they had expected to be. But there was, nevertheless, a great deal of very sound matter in what was said, and the lecture seasoned with a fair amount of dry humour. Sir Edwin Elgar had not very much to say that was complimentary to English music at the present time, but he is hopeful of much better things from the modern English school. Despite the criticism in the press, there were those who left Elgar's first lecture inspired, among them Granville Bantock.
"My dear Edward, you have done a fine thing for our English musical art. Your address was a noble effort and a notable achievement. Putting aside personal gratitude, which I am not likely to forget, I must thank you for all the kind, encouraging words you spoke. The future is hopeful indeed. We are all proud of you. Yours ever, Graham."
When Elgar accepted the chair initially, he made it clear that teaching was strictly off-limits and he would give 6 lectures in the first year. There were, however, no students to teach at that point, and by the end of 1905 he had indeed delivered his 6 lectures, although most of the time their preparation was like pulling teeth. Just 2 days before he was due to give his 2nd lecture, for example, Elgar wrote to his friend and patron, Frank Schuster.
"My dear Frank, delighted to have your letter, of which more anon. All else must wait, as I am killed with the university. Oh, how I wish when we, passed Hotel Kruger, the bombs had gone off and killed no one but your poor distracted. E.E.
Elgar came close to throwing in the towel the following year, and having given 2 more lectures in November 1906, that, he told the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, would be it.
"My dear Fiedler, I am not supposed to write at all, but I must send a line to you. My eyes have failed. I have been to one of the best specialists here and am ordered entire rest. I'm fairly well in body generally, but the eyes are not. I much regret the lectures must be given up. With greatest regret, yours ever, Edward Elgar."
In many ways, Elgar's 3 years as chair of music at Birmingham were a failure. But his lectures, despite their controversy, inspired some, such as the young composer Julius Harrison, speaking here on the BBC in the 1960s.
"As a student in Birmingham in 1905, I heard his lecture on Brahms's 3rd symphony, given at the university. I was so impressed by his analysis of that masterpiece, with all its wonderful treatment of a motto phrase, that the memory of that lecture still remains vivid to my eyes and ears. I still can see and hear him, his eyelids batting rapidly with that nervous tension and energy which all those who knew him will remember. His whole mind concentrated on a subject so near to his own ideals and music.
Elgar also helped to set up the music library, encouraging friends in high places to donate money for scores. And the university library still has some of them here. We've got the symphonies of Schubert and cantatas of J.S. Bach, which were part of a whole set. The University Music Society was well established by the time Elgar left, and he and Bantock were working hard to find the money for a regular series of orchestral concerts in Birmingham.
My dear Gran, I think we should encourage ladies to be guarantors and be interested. We could get Lady Lodge and Mrs. Beale and Mrs. Johnston. We could give them a separate list, sort of Valkyries. Think of it, Birmingham Valkyries choosing symphonic poems for Valhalla.
Elgar arranged for a series of visiting lecturers to take his place in 1907, and then in the summer of 1908, he left it to Richard Peyton's wife Harriet to break the news to the donor of the chair of music.
Dear Mrs. Peyton, I am very sorry indeed to trouble you, but I do not like to break some very sad news directly to Mr. Peyton, and I think you might perhaps be so extremely kind as to prepare the way.
So poor Mr. Peyton there was very disappointed to have backed the wrong horse, but next to Peyton's portrait is a picture of the man who stepped into Elgar's shoes as Peyton Professor of Music, someone we've heard a lot about already. Andrew Kirkman, current Peyton and Barber Professor of Music, can you tell us who your predecessor is?
Yes, really, Bantock was essentially the founder of this music department. Bantock assumed the chair in 1908, and like many of his successors, he had a long tenure. In fact, he stayed here for 26 years until 1934. One of the interesting things about Bantock is that he introduced the first syllabus for a BMus degree, and it has quite a lot in common with what we still do today. We still have composition as an essential part of the degree that started under Bantock's tenure. He was also keen on harmony and counterpoint and giving people the rudiments, the basics of how to actually manipulate notes, and also the analysis of music. And he included a number of very recent pieces for the time, including Strauss's Salome and Elgar's First Symphony, were actually brand new pieces at that point. In fact, we learned that that caused a little bit of a ruckus with Mary Chamberlain, the wife of Joseph Chamberlain, who was a little bit sniffy about these newfangled pieces of music. But anyway, it shows that there's quite a range in Bantock's syllabus from the classics and, in fact, before, right up to the then present day.
Bantock developed an enormously influential circle around him in the Midlands, and he was a great source of energy. Things happened when Bantock took an interest, and he worked at an amazing speed both in writing music and in fixing things up. So he was in touch with everybody, and that, I'm sure, fed through to his students. And the courses that he ran at Birmingham were of the widest. His students had to speak languages, had to have a wide non-musical knowledge as well as musical training. I think the persona that Bantock projected was one of comfortable and easygoing, while at the same time not lacking in standards, musical standards. Certainly we have that story, which I think originated with Cyril Neal, the director of the London publishers Paxton, of Bantock being the first professor to wear a corduroy suit in an academic meeting.
Andrew, we've come into your office to talk more about what you're doing at the university today. We've talked a lot about Granville Bantock and Edward Elgar, but of course the other figure who is so important in this is Richard Peyton, having given the money.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, Peyton is the first, I suppose, cornerstone of a series of important philanthropic moves that have occurred through the history of the department. The next big moment, of course, came with the Barbers, the Barber Trust, which endowed the building, which became the centre of the music department in 1939. And still funds part of the chair, which is now the Peyton and Barber chair. The next milestone really has come in the past couple of years with the gift of a very substantial sum by Liz and Terry Bramall, who endowed money for the building of that we're actually sitting in now, the Bramall Music Building. Terry and Liz like Peyton and like Lady Barbara before them, have taken a major interest in what actually goes on here. So that's, I think, an ongoing tradition.
Andrew, whose legacy do you think is most important to the university? Is it Elgar's or Bantock's?
Well, I think we owe something substantial to both of them in their very different ways. In the case of Elgar, or the E word, as he's referred to by a colleague of mine, we've done rather well out of his name, I suppose one might say. We had an Elgar room in which we used to practice, and now we have the Elgar Concert Hall, and of course Elgar's bust and his picture are plastered all over the building. So he's rather like Mozart in Salzburg to that extent, I think. But of course, Bantock is really the paterfamilias of the whole enterprise. He's the author of the first syllabus and really the person who started the ball rolling with the permanent BMUS course.
It's touching to read in the University Council minutes in March 1934 that everyone there stood in silence to mark the death of Sir Edward Elgar. For all the difficulty Elgar must have caused the university at the time, Birmingham was and still is very proud of its connection with him. When I was a student here, we had rehearsals in the Elgar Concert Room. The new music building has the Elgar Concert Hall, and both he and Bantock are honoured with a blue plaque outside. The clock tower finally completed in 1909, just as the first music students arrived here to study with Bantock, stands as a tangible reminder of those days, and a symbol of the pride in Birmingham that inspired Richard Peyton to fund a professorship he hoped would foster a love of music in the city. That Birmingham is a centre for classical music today, as Richard Peyton intended, owes something to the name of Edward Elgar and a great deal to the endeavours of Granville Bantock.
Elgar and Bantock in Birmingham was presented by Fiona Clampin and produced in Bristol by James Cook. The readers were Michael Burtonshaw and Sean Murray. A welcome back from me, Penny Gore, to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, live on BBC Radio 3 and online in HD sound. Edward Elgar and Granville Bantock are centre stage for the rest of the concert. The Enigma variations to end, and before that, Bantock's Celtic Symphony, one of five works during the 2013 prom season by this often overlooked composer. Although he was born in London, he was the son of a distinguished Scottish surgeon, and towards the end of his life, in 1940, Bantock returned to his Scottish roots with this Celtic Symphony, which is in a single movement lasting about 20 minutes. It's scored for strings alone and calls for no fewer than six harps. Here's Sakari Oromo.
It's actually very simple music. As often in Bantock, his mastery was in the way he created atmospheres out of very, very simple means. And in that sense, he actually is a total contrast of Elgar, who had such a wonderfully large array of material always at his disposal. I mean, he could invent endless motifs and tunes and vary them. Bantock had very little material, but he did quite a lot with it. It's an archaic sound world. It uses a lot of open fifths. It has this kind of chant-like character in the two first movements, and then obviously very dance-like in the last movement, which is a Hebridean folk dance. To have six harps slightly spread out in space is actually a very interesting sound, because it's a sound that's not incredibly powerful, but it has a long ring to it. The after sound of six harps playing a chord and letting it ring is absolutely massive. I mean, it makes the whole room vibrate.
Sakari Oromo and those six harps are ranged on the stage now behind the string players, and very splendid they are too. Fantastic instruments and very unusual indeed. I've certainly never seen six harps before on a concert platform in the one concert. Members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra have returned to the stage, making ready for this piece. Bantock was a fantastically prolific composer. He began his studies at the Royal Academy of Music in 1888, and throughout his long life he wrote around 800 pieces, and many of them were inspired by Scottish folklore and music, including his Hebridean Symphony. He also made settings of Marjorie Kennedy Fraser's collections of traditional Hebridean songs. So a string of Scottish-inspired pieces. And this piece is relatively late in his life. It was written in 1940. You tend to overlook the fact that Bantok was a contemporary of Sibelius and was also a very good friend of Sibelius's, so that links the two halves of tonight's prom together. Sibelius was, in fact, the very first president of the Granville Bantok Society when it was founded in 1946. And the prommers just squeezing forwards now, getting to the front of the arena in preparation for the next work in tonight's prom. And to conduct the Celtic Symphony by Granville Bantok. They're welcoming back on stage Sakari Oromo to join the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The Celtic Symphony by Ranveer Bantok. One of the five works by this composer featured at the BBC Proms this year. Performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sakari Oramo. Strings and six harps. And if you go online to the Proms website and consult the archive, well, you'll see there that it's the first Proms performance of this piece. Bantok had a very long career and an incredibly varied one, though he almost didn't make it into music at all. His father thought he should do something a bit more secure and wanted him to go into the Indian Civil Service. And those cheers that you can hear now are for the half dozen harpists: Seanad Williams, Louise Martin, Robert Johnston, Hugh Webb, Manon Morris and Lucy Haslar. And another cheer for principal cello Susan Monks, who played that lovely song-like melody in the second section of the work. And the next piece by Bantok to be heard at the Proms will be his piece The Witch of Atlas. That's in a few days' time. Well, Sakari Oramo makes his way off stage. The orchestra take their places again, at least some of them do, because what comes onto the platform must go off, and those six harps are going to be taken off stage now and the platform slightly rearranged in preparation for music by Edward Elgar. In the late autumn of 1898, from his home in Malvern, Elgar wrote a chatty letter to his old friend Alfred Jaeger. "I've sketched a set of variations on an original theme," he said. "They've amused me because I've labelled them with the nicknames of my particular friends. That is to say, I've written the variations, each one to represent the mood of the party. I've liked to imagine the party writing the variations, him or herself, and have written what I think they would have written if they were asses enough to compose. It's a quaint idea, and the result's amusing to those behind the scenes, and won't affect the hearer who knows nothing." Well, we're going to hear his set of variations shortly and meet his friends pictured within, many of whom had often been entertained by Elgar's habit of sitting at the piano and just improvising away. He was so fond of doing this that in 1929, he even had himself recorded at the Queen's Hall performing a series of short, off-the-cuff pieces. Here's one of them, inspired by a theme from Rossini's William Tell. Edward Elgar in 1929 playing one of his own piano improvisations. Although he once noted mischievously, "I never play the pianoforte. I scramble through things orchestrally in a way that would madden with envy all existing pianists." Well, tonight's conductor, Sakari Oromo, is a noted Elgarian, awarded the Elgar Medal in 2008.
The shape of the Enigma variations is such that it doesn't require the same amount of concentration from a listener than, for instance, an Elgar symphony does. It's the variation form, which I think he's one of the most successful people in the history of world music in using, perhaps besides Haydn and Brahms. But I think seeing an Elgar as a national monument doesn't really do him justice, because he himself shied away from such a position. I mean, he liked to be loved, but he was such a deep, private, troubled person. And I think Elgar's music is universal. If you put him into this kind of Imperial Britain category, he obviously did a lot for that, but I mean, his music has so much more as well.
Sakari Oromo, who's conducted and recorded so many of Elgar's works. Well, we know quite a lot about the Enigma variations, but we still don't know quite everything. Elgar kept one final tease up his sleeve. He announced mysteriously that the enigma of the title would never be explained. Its dark saying must be left unguessed. Further through and over the whole set, another and larger theme goes, but is not played. A typically Sphinx-like Elgarian remark, which has given entertainment to puzzle lovers ever since. Well, I don't know whether we'll unravel that puzzle tonight, but we are in for a treat. Here comes Sakari Oromo to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Elgar's Enigma Variations. The Royal Albert Hall organ joining with the orchestra in the close of Elgar's musical enigma, his variations on an original theme. 14 portraits of friends and family, including, in the last variation, himself. It's marked with the nickname his wife gave him, Edu. And appropriately enough, she appears as CAE in the very first variation and returns to in the last, so they're united. Conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra here at the BBC Proms was Sakari Oromo, whose Elgar Medal was awarded in 2008 for his work in furthering the reputation of Elgar and his music in the composer's 150th anniversary year. Oromo was then the conductor of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. His love of Elgar's works hasn't diminished in the years since. And some solo calls now. Richard Hosford, principal clarinet, getting a special bow. Malcolm Hicks playing the Royal Albert Hall organ. And Sakari Oromo taking a deep bow with all the members of the orchestra on their feet. And he's going round now, waving for some special recognition for the separate sections of the orchestra, all playing their part in these witty variations, picking out aspects of Elgar's friends' characters that would amuse them, even including in Variation 11, the bulldog Dan, owned by his friend George Robertson Sinclair. But the deepest feeling, of course, reserved for his dear friend August Jaeger, Nimrod, of Variation 9. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra will be back at the Royal Albert Hall a week today when their programme includes Stravinsky's Petrushka. But tomorrow there are two proms, and in the first of them, the Rotterdam Philharmonic is conducted by Yannick Nezet-Seguin in Tchaikovsky, Wagner and Prokofiev. That starts at 7 o'clock. But for now, from Elgar's Friends Pictured Within, that's about all from me. It's back to our friend in Broadcasting House, Jonathan Swain.
Penny, thank you very much. Penny Gore there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom here on BBC Radio 3 next Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, of course, if you want to listen to it when you want to listen to it, every prom is available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast. And if Param Vir's piece that opened tonight's prom struck a chord, his Cave of Luminous Mind, well, in just over 5 minutes tonight, Param Vir is the subject of the next of our Proms Composer Portraits. He talks about his work to Andrew McGregor and introduces a selection of his chamber pieces. That's at 10:15 this evening. Wagner, tomorrow night, as Penny was saying at the Proms, his Wesendonck songs, sung by Anna Katharina Antonacci. And Wagner's final masterpiece of music drama is at the Proms on Sunday.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Wagner's Parsifal. Lars Klavermann, John Tomlinson and Katharina de Leijman star in Wagner's final epic drama of renunciation and redemption. Mark Elder conducts the Halle in Parsifal. Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3 at 4:30.
And as Penny was saying, there's Prokofiev in tomorrow night's first prom, his magnificent Fifth Symphony. Well, this is Prokofiev on a smaller scale. Violinist Vadim Repin and pianist Boris Berezovsky in a couple of Prokofiev's five melodies, Opus 35. Melodies for voice and piano originally that Prokofiev reworked in 1925 for violin and piano. He wrote the originals while touring California in 1921. As vocalises for the Russian mezzo and one-time lover of Rachmaninoff, Nina Koschets. But the general consensus seems to be they work better in these violin and piano versions. These, as I say, are the last two of them. Thank you. the last two of Prokofiev's Five Melodies, Opus 35, the violinist playing them there, Vadim Repin, and the pianist was Boris Berezovsky. And Prokofiev's magnificent Fifth Symphony closes the first of tomorrow night's proms, one that includes Wagner's Wesendonck songs and opens with Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet. Yannick Nezet-Séguin conducts the Rotterdam Philharmonic. And that's all from 7 o'clock tomorrow night, live from the Royal Albert Hall, here on BBC Radio 3. Where it's now a quarter past ten, and now for one of our proms composer portraits recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It's introduced by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome. We're all here to meet Paramveer, the composer of the new work in this evening's prom, Cave of Luminous Mind, and to find out more about his music with the help of young performers from the Royal Academy of Music in London, who'll be playing three pieces of chamber music by Veer for us, one of which will be a world premiere, so the second we're going to hear this evening. And it's a piece that's intimately linked with his proms commission, as we'll be finding out. Now, Param, the first piece we're going to hear is Constellations from 2010, written for the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group. Is it literally a depiction of patterns of stars and the way they move around?
I think I try not to depict anything, because I think when I was very young, I used to do that. I think about the energy or the emotion behind that idea, whether it's a constellation of stars or a mythological subject, and I act from the emotion and the feeling of that, and that might translate into something that people might relate to directly.
But in terms of the organization of the piece, we have a fairly constant ritornello, which is depicting the Milky Way in some way, yes. Or at least the energy of the Milky
it's
Way.
It's twinkly.
Exactly, and we have three separate constellations which you've chosen. Explain how they work and how they interact.
Well, the constellations have different colors and different rhythms in each set of constellations. And what I did was organize them as a kind of a mobile piece with small fragments that the musicians can play in any order. So the Milky Way is a ritornello, which returns and which is fully scored and plays from beginning to end. I think it's about 2 minutes long. And then you have interspersed between that constellations of stars, and those are mobiles for the instrumentalists. In fact, the performance you're going to hear now has never ever before happened in the history of music because they're going to choose the fragments spontaneously, responding to each other. I think even the conductor doesn't know who's going to play what first. So it's always a magical thing. Sometimes in the rehearsal, you find extraordinary things happen because of the conjunction of these mobiles.
And we should just say that the three constellations are Orion, which is led by the piano, isn't
it? That's right.
And then the plough, that's percussion section.
Mm-hmm.
You won't miss that.
And no.
Pegasus, which is the
dancing horse. Yeah.
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 Well, I think we should hear it. To perform Constellations by Paramveer, please welcome our ensemble from the Royal Academy of Music and conductor Karin Hendrickson.
Thank you. Thank you.
three soloistic constellations, Orion the Plough and Pegasus moving alongside the ritornello of the Milky Way. That was Constellations by Param Veer, performed by musicians from the Royal Academy of Music in London. Flautist Emma Howland, clarinetist Oliver James, violinist Kate Southers, cellist Ireal Evans, percussionist Tom Lee, harpist Olivia Jagers, pianist Masahito Yamaguchi, and they were all conducted by Karen Hendrickson. And the next piece we're going to hear involves just two performers, cellist and percussionist, so there's going to be some rearrangement of the stage behind us as we're talking, Param. So listening to Constellations, it instinctively feels as though, well, exactly what you said just before we heard it, that the energy is the starting point, but you're more concerned about energy and movement and colour than perhaps about architecture and any kind of method when it comes to your compositions.
Well, in this piece, it's not that architectural. It's a short piece. But of course, larger pieces, you have to write architecturally, as I've done with the orchestral work.
And with the difference between these two pieces, the large orchestral Proms Commission and Constellations we've just heard, is the starting point for you the same? You begin with this idea of the sound and the energy, and then some kind of notation you draw, I think, don't you?
Yes, the starting point for all my pieces is in that sense the same, in that it you want to find within yourself something that you want to write about and say with some conviction and feeling. I think without feeling, there isn't any point in writing the music. So I must be sure that I really want to write this piece and what the feeling is about. And then this leads to a sound impression, which can come from different sources. Sometimes you may just start with the sound and you suddenly realize that this is linking to something else. And then I normally get a very vivid sound impression, which I can only describe as a kind of sound sculpture. I hear the music, obviously, not in all detail, but I hear the music and I also see a visual sculpture. It isn't a sculpture of a work of art. It's just something to do with lines and colors and so on, shapes. And I draw that out very quickly because that's a way in which you can put the idea down very strongly and very accurately without messing around with notation and pitches and ledger lines and staffs of music and treble clefs and bass clefs, you know. It's a graphical. I don't think I would call it art in any sense. It's simply energy, a shorthand, an energy imprint of this way the sound would appear to a listener.
So an energy imprint, I like that idea. And then what's the next step?
Well, I call them energy templates, as it happens. And then from that, you get what I usually do is write a rhythmic template. And the rhythmic template is a very exact barring, controlling of the time sequence of the piece, the orchestration. It will contain the way the sections change, the way groups of instruments would come in and out. And it's very exactly rhythmic. It doesn't have any pitch. The pitch formations are happening quite separately, and you put them down on pitch schemes. And then you have to blend the two together to create a whole image.
So that rhythmic organization is the point at which the structure really comes into focus for you.
Quite. That would be a good way to describe it. It comes into focus with the rhythmic template.
I was just curious because I was reading that you were exposed to serialism, the second Viennese school, the new Viennese school, very early in your life as a musician. You were just a teenager, weren't you, I think?
I was 14 years old and I was in New Delhi, and there was nobody really in India who could have taught me composition. But the director of the Goethe Institute happened to be a gentleman called Hans Joachim Kohlreuter, who had fled the Nazi era in Germany and gone to Brazil, where he took the 12-tone system. So I was his student for 2 years, and he was the director of the Goethe Institute in Delhi. They don't call it that, they call it the Max Müller Bhavan. And he introduced me to 12-tone technique. I still have a copy of Webern's Opus 27, the piano variations. Immediately after that, I modeled a song called The Beggar, which had the same structural idea in the tone row, the way the tone row is used. But of course, I've departed from that a long time ago.
And I'm curious about other elements of your early life as a musician, because, well, you were born in Delhi. Your mother was a singer, I believe. She sang in the North Indian classical tradition. So this was the music you were steeped in. What made you move allegiance, as it were, to Western classical tradition?
I have no idea.